Well, parapsychological, as you say. On the cover of the book, it says a memoir of non-ordinary experience.
Right.
How would you define non-ordinary experience?
Almost synonymously with parapsychological or extrasensory, I would say.
When did you start cataloging some of these non-ordinary experiences?
All right. Well, what happened with me was that these things always were interesting to me. I was the kind of kid who loved reading Ripley's Believe It or Not and Frank Edwards' Truth is Stranger Than Fiction books, and I just have never really ever left from that interest. But in, a couple of years back, the Unitarian Church here asked me to do a sermon, and I came up with a sermon called Sacred Exchanges with Nature. And it was really based on a premise that I'd been exploring for years and read some research about, that things like prayer and blessing and just our love and affection for our gardens, any aspect of nature, actually has the potential of having some kind of positive effect, say, on the growth of plants. There's a book called The Secret Life of Plants that some people remember that shares some of that research. And so in the course of doing this sermon for the Unitarians, I decided, and it felt like a little risk, that I would share a couple of experiences I'd had which were distinctly non-ordinary and really got my attention. And I was surprised to see that the Unitarians seemed interested. And I got to thinking afterwards, how many experiences have I had where, like these two that I'm mentioning, someone else witnessed what was going on, or there was some sort of confirmation afterwards, such as you might find if you had a precognitive dream that came true. And I began to journal in the mornings as I remembered things, and some of you will know what it's like when you start to prime the pump of memory, other things, other associations begin to flow, and to my surprise, something like 70 or 80 different recollections came to me. Not all of them quite as confirmatory as the best ones, but generally having some kind of element of extraordinary synchronicity or just outright pointing to some kind of capacities that human beings have to move outside of what we normally think of as our ability to understand things through our senses into a larger dimension of awareness.
You write about some of those precognitive dreams and also about your first house in Fayetteville where there might have been some events.
Might have been, yeah. So what we noticed there, we were living adjacent to an old farmstead, and it had been sectioned off, but originally had been a 400-acre place. And there had been a lot of activity around that place for a long time, since pre-Civil War. And we noticed that in our house there seemed to be an extra presence. We'd see it peripherally. I saw it and didn't report it, and a young woman who was a boarder in our home at that time also noticed it and reported it independently. And there were other instances which I can't vouch for as clearly, but what happened with this presence in the home was that one night I went downstairs to get a snack, and I saw this ghostly presence. It was very distinct. It was purple and floating. And heaven knows how many times I've heard reports of ghosts in Great Britain where it was associated with a figure coming down a stairway. I don't know why that is, but it's interesting. This was similar. The figure was at the top of the stairway. And I was scared. I have been a practicing Buddhist for some time. So the thing I knew to do would be to try out a mantra and to say it with an intention for the liberation or the peace of this apparently unquiet, kind of unhappy and restless spirit. I walked through this presence, this strange thing with this mantra, and went down, got my snack, came upstairs. The stairway was phantom free as far as I could tell, and I went back into the bedroom. And my wife was half awake, and the window was half open. There was a screen. And she said, "Oh, what was that? It looked like a black moth, but it flew out through the screen. How could that be?" This was no prior information about my strange experience on the stairway. We never saw that face peripherally again.
Some of the anecdotes that you relate in the book, and we should say the book is titled A Country Where All Colors Are Sacred and Alive. Some of the anecdotes, you mentioned that you're with someone who is and you painstakingly point out, perhaps not as tuned in or as ready to accept non-ordinary events.
Sure.
I think that's interesting.
And maybe I was that person in certain situations, too. I think it's interesting, too, and I think that when I grew up in Kansas City, I was pretty much surrounded by people who, for them, as part of their evolution, it was important for them to disavow traditional organized religion. They had had a good look during World War II at what different manifestations of nationalism and belief caused and cost, and they wanted to move beyond different kinds of sectarian views. And they pretty much threw the what I would say is the beautiful, unconditioned baby of spirituality out with the bathwater, the historically murky bathwater of religiosity. Although there's great beauty in religion, these folks really just rejected the whole thing and didn't consider anything possible other than what we take in with our senses, which is certainly a view that I respect. And I saw these people as very kind and good people. But as I was growing up, I started spontaneously having things happen to me that couldn't be fit into that box.
I read this as, this is what's happened to me, this is what I thought about it. And if 700 people read this tomorrow, you might have 700 different interpretations or people that come away.
Really, whether it's a book or a radio broadcast for that matter, I'm sure that there are going to be people that embrace what's heard or read, and there are going to be people that really are neutral, and there sure are going to be people who encounter this material and feel negative about it. So it's to my advantage not to be overly didactic, but it's also to my personal advantage not to be too sure I'm right about any of this, because my goodness, if any of this points towards anything, it's to a larger perspective than many of us have considered, and I'm sure it's much larger than I'm aware of.
When I was reading this, I began realizing, gosh, there just aren't that many non-ordinary events in my life.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, you know, some people, flat out, I'm a skeptic of everything.
Okay.
But at the same time, I don't doubt any of these things happened. Or where does that leave people like me?
Well, I don't know. I think you could certainly doubt my interpretation of these things and know that I perceived them, but it's especially impressive to me when somebody else was right there with me and perceived them, and I'm able to report that. I don't know where it leaves any of us, although I think we're each one of us at a disadvantage if we close down our account on reality and don't pay attention. And so, you know, I may be at a disadvantage too at a given moment when I'm not paying attention, and maybe what I need to pay attention to is distinctly non-ordinary, but very much what's right in front of me.
Or maybe I should step back and maybe I've had some non-ordinary things and whizzed past them. When I've talked to you before, it's mostly been about your poetry.
Yeah.
Do you think the attempt to try to observe more, to take in more, helps you in writing poetry?
I think so. And I think some of my poems are an attempt to share some of these distinctly unusual events while, I'm going to say, in a sense, hiding as well as advancing behind a metaphorical shield. I don't think I've ever tried to be as clear and explicit and claim these things in the way that I've done in this book. So poetry has helped me to observe, but at the same time, it's allowed me to stay in the realm of that which is poetic and not necessarily literally to be taken as true.
You write about something in this book, and if you don't want to talk about this,
okay,
it's fine. But you mention your friend John Locke, who of course was a professor on the University of Arkansas campus, tragically killed on campus. And you mentioned that you called to his office.
I can't account for this. I called John, and I hadn't called him for, I'm sure, months. We were friends, but not terribly close, and I felt a sudden urge to call him, and when I did, there'd already been, the student was holed up in the office with John, and I heard a shot while I was on the phone. I don't think that was the shot that killed him, but there were three, I think.
it is hard to merely dismiss that you wanted to call him mm-hmm. when you hadn't called him or you didn't call him often.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not something that can be pointed to as proof of any kind of foreknowledge, but I think it would make sense to neither accept it or reject it out of hand.
I think that's what your book does. To me, it doesn't necessarily accept nor reject anything. It says, consider.
Good. I want that.
We should mention you'll be reading from and signing copies of the book.
Yes, thanks. At Nightbird Books on Saturday, May the 5th at 7 p.m. And then in the Walker Room at the Fayetteville Public Library on May the 22nd, which I think is a Tuesday, at 6:45 p.m., I'll be doing another reading. And in both cases, Kyle, as time allows, I will invite people to share some of the things that come up for them as they hear these stories. And there may be things that are brought up, and it would be a lot of fun to do something more participatory. So that's what I'll be doing.
Thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much.